Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. What better way to introduce a show about space than with the opening strains of Robert Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra, with made iconic, of course, thanks to Stanley Kubrick's groundbreaking film 2001: A Space Odyssey. These days, astrophysicists and space enthusiasts imagine not just space tourism, but also colonization. NASA's recent discovery of an Earth-like planet just 4.2 light years away raises the inevitable question: could humans survive out there? We're talking about life in space and maybe on other planets. Joining us by phone is the publisher of UniverseToday.com and co-host of AstronomyCast.com, Fraser Cain. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In the studio, Ohio State University astrophysicist and the chief scientist at COSI Columbus, Paul Sutter. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks for having me. Can I have that music intro me everywhere I go?
It's so, you know,
it's pretty
wow.
Intense.
It's
like
very
it.
Intense. And, you know, all I do is I see the big, you know, whatever it is.
The monolith.
The monolith, right? That's all I can see. Instead of my microphone. Let's first talk about this new planet discovery by NASA. It's called Proxima B. It orbits around Proxima Centauri, the nearest star to Earth. Mm-hmm. Why did it take so long for astronomers to find it? It's only 4.2 light years away.
Yeah. So let's talk about Proxima Centauri. Even though it's the closest star to our own sun, it's a red dwarf star. It's about 1/10 the size of our sun. So you can't even see it with the naked eye. That's how dim it is.
Okay.
And we use several methods for identifying planets around other stars, what we call exoplanets. And the most common method is what's called a transit method, where you wait for a planet to line up just right and kind of cross the face of that distant star, and the brightness of that star will dip a little bit and then brighten back up when that transit is finished. But we have to wait for very lucky alignments for that to happen. So we build observatories and we just look at star after star after star after star, and every once in a while we'll catch one of these transits. But it only works if it's lined up just right, if the planet is actually in the line between us and that star. With Proxima Centauri, there's no transit. This planet that's orbiting it doesn't line up that way.
Okay.
So we have to use a different method. And the method we use to identify this planet is actually looking at the wobble of the star itself. Like, imagine, and you're looking at me like with your brows furrowed, so I'll explain it. Like, imagine you go with a kid and you have the kid hang onto a rope and you start spinning the kid around. Mm-hmm. The kid is like orbiting you, but you kind of rock back and forth. That same thing happens, but with gravity. As a planet orbits a star, it tugs on that star just a little bit and makes that star wobble back and forth. This actually happens in our own solar system, like Jupiter is doing it to our own sun as we speak. So when we look at, say, Proxima Centauri, it's wobbling a little bit back and forth. The challenge with Proxima Centauri of just looking for this wobble is it's a very active star, very unstable. There's lots of flares. Its brightness is changing back and forth. It's doing all sorts of complex stuff anyway. So you have to filter all that out to look for this very subtle, very small signal of the wobble back and forth from the planet. So even though it's the closest star, it's actually like really, really hard to pick out any planets around that star.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about potentially human life in space. You just heard from Paul Sutter. He's an astrophysicist at OSU and also chief scientist at COSI Columbus. And with us by phone, Fraser Cain. He's publisher of UniverseToday.com and also co-host of AstronomyCast.com. If you have questions about life in outer space, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. As I work to unfurl my brows because it's bad for my complexion, Fraser Cain, can you say why is it, why do we know so much about Proxima, this new planet Proxima B, if it's so far away and it's been so hard to even figure out if it exists in the first place? The next thing you know, we have artist renderings of what it might look like.
Well, I don't think we know very much at all, really. I mean, you know, the artist renderings are helpful, but there's been a lot of discussion and argument in the scientific community about what really is there. And, you know, people have been using this term Earth-like, that there's an Earth-like planet found around Proxima Centauri. But that's even a, you know, a point of big contention, because really what all we really do know is that there's a mass of a planet that is somewhat roughly similar to the Earth. I think it's about, 1.2 times the mass of the Earth.
Yeah. About the same size.
Yeah. 20.
Yeah, about the same. You know, it orbits, it orbits its parent star every 11.2 days. It's probably tidally locked directly facing at the red dwarf star, which is giving out these tremendous and terrifying blasts of radiation. You know, it's known as a flare star. So, as Paul said, it's, you know, it's a very bad place to be close to. It is located within the habitable zone, but I'm using kind of air quotes to say that, because it is within the region that liquid water could form and could be sort of present on the surface. But then, you know, in our own solar system, Venus is located within our solar system's habitable zone, and so is Mars. So, and we know both of those are very uninhabitable. So we actually really don't know a lot, but, you know, because Proxima Centauri is so close, we want to know a lot more. And I think that over the next couple of years, it's going to be the subject of a tremendous amount of research and speculation. And so I think, you know, when you see these artist impressions, that's all it is someone just going, well, it could look like this, maybe?
Yeah, we know even less than that. Like, we know the minimum mass of this planet. It's at least 30% more massive than the Earth. But because of the limitations of this detection method, it could be much heavier. And we don't know the size of the planet. So it could be a very large, very less dense planet, or a very compact, very highly dense planet. Based on what we have so far, we just don't know.
Could there be a system of planets like we have a solar system here?
Oh, absolutely. And there's some very tiny suggestions that maybe there's a much larger planet, like a gas giant, in a further orbit, but we're not exactly sure about that signal. It hasn't been pinned down yet.
I wanted to create some context for our listeners. If you're on Proxima B, can you see our sun from there? Would you be able to? Is our sun that much bigger and brighter?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the cool things about it is that Proxima is part of we're very close to the Alpha Centauri system. And those are actually two stars that are very similar to the mass and size of the sun. And so in our night sky, the folks in the southern hemisphere can see Alpha Centauri quite nicely. So if you were on Proxima Centauri, the sun would look about as bright as Alpha Centauri looks to us. So it would be one of the brighter stars in the sky.
Okay. And as far as that sense about what a light year is, it's how long it takes the light to reach us. So it takes 4.2 years for the light from Proxima Centauri to reach us. But what does that mean in terms of distance? I said, as a crow flies, something like 80,000 years or something like that.
Yeah. So one of the common examples I like to use is to build a scale model. So let's take our own solar system and compress it down so that the distance between the Earth and the sun is just 3 feet. So I'm sitting across the desk from you, a little more than 3 feet, but let's call it 3 feet. Do you want to be the sun or the Earth?
The sun.
Okay, so you're the sun. I'm 3 feet away. I'm the Earth. Pluto, which New Horizons just flew by last year, that's about down the hall. It's about 120 feet away from you.
Okay.
Proxima Centauri is in Cleveland in that model. It's 200 miles away in this little scale model. So if we shrunk the distance from the sun to the Earth to just 3 feet, then Proxima Centauri is 200 miles away. That is literally astronomically far away. These are just ridiculously large numbers, incredibly long distances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fastest spacecraft that have ever been sent from Earth and are leaving the solar system now would still take you tens of thousands of years to make the journey to Proxima Centauri.
So for people out there who are hoping for sort of that space colonization scenario, something big has to happen. We have to figure something out big, because it's just not humanly possible.
or just get to know our solar system really, really well.
Meaning?
Our own solar system is, compared to
do it
the
here
distant
versus
stars,
there.
You know, we've got Mars, we've got asteroids, we've got the moon, we've got Europa, we've got all sorts of cool things in our own solar system that are much more accessible than other stars.
Okay. So why the great interest then, Fraser Cain? You said, I think you're appalled, but this is a big, big deal. Why?
Well, I mean, one of the things is that it's one of these records that can never be broken, right? That we have, that astronomers have finally found the closest possible planet, which I think is pretty fascinating. And that because it is this planet orbiting around our closest neighbor, it is, I mean, maybe people have this sort of fondness for Proxima Centauri because it's so close. But I think also it is this really unprecedented opportunity to study an extrasolar planet that is only, merely 4.25 light years away, that over the coming years, when the James Webb Space Telescope launches, when new and better observatories are put up in space, we're going to have this chance to see a planet closer than anything else, because, 4.25 light years is very close compared to the tens, hundreds, or even thousands of light years away that all of the other planets that we've discovered are. So this is our best place, our best chance to observe what another solar system could look like.
You know, Fraser just said something, Paul Sutter, that made me think, maybe the first step with any kind of colonization of any of the planets in our solar system or celestial objects they might pick, it begins probably with sort of robotic type things, not humans necessarily, but telescopes.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the first things we do when we want to understand the universe, whether that's our nearby solar system or the outer solar system or distant stars and galaxies, is to observe with very powerful telescopes, with very powerful instruments. And Fraser made an excellent point of why this is exciting and interesting. Even if it's this Proxima B planet is completely uninhabitable, which it probably is, it is the closest extrasolar planet. So if we want to study extrasolar planets in general, that's our best target of opportunity because it's right there. It, like Fraser said, it doesn't get any closer than this, even though it's still super far away. It doesn't get any closer than that. So we can observe it. We can potentially image it. We can learn about other planets in that Proxima system. I believe there are even planets around Alpha Centauri, around the binary star that Proxima orbits. And so this is what we're going to look at to learn more about the formation of planets, how common Earth-like planets are, the potential for life elsewhere in the galaxy. This is a place where we're going to look.
This hour, we're talking about wherever that place might be, what it would take to live on it, too. You just heard from Paul Sutter. He's astrophysicist at Ohio State University and chief scientist at COSI. Also with us by phone, Fraser Cain, publisher of theuniversetoday.com and co-host of astronomycast.com. Coming up, we're going to hear from a director, producer of a film about living, about living on another planet. It hasn't actually happened yet, but it has been simulated. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the future of space travel and colonization of other planets, other celestial objects. In the movie The Martian, astronaut Mark Watney, played by Matt Damon, is left for dead on Mars after a mission goes awry. While he waits for NASA to bring him home, he hopes, fingers crossed, he works out how to stay alive until then.
Right. Let's do the math. Our service mission here was supposed to last 31 souls. For redundancy, they sent 68 souls worth of food. That's for 6 people. So for just me, that's going to last 300 souls, which I figure I can stretch to 400 if I ration. So I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist.
That isn't just Hollywood. NASA has been experimenting with growing food in space to give astronauts access to fresh produce. Still with us is the publisher of UniverseToday.com and co-host of AstronomyCast.com, Fraser Kane, OSU astrophysicist and the chief scientist at COSI, Paul Sutter. And joining us now by phone is Kai Stotz. He's space researcher and director at Over the Sun. It's a science film production company in Utah. Welcome to the show, Kai.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
In 2014, you were involved in the Mars Analog Research Station, which simulates life on the red planet. Tell us about that.
That was a fantastic experience. It was an opportunity to be with six other astronauts from 6 different countries. And we had never met. Only 2 people had met prior to the experience of being there. So we met for the first time at the front door of the Mars Desert Research Station. And it was 2 very intense and also very memorable weeks. We all remain friends today and actually host Skype calls even over two years later on a regular basis, just to stay in touch and see how the research is going following that experience.
That was 2 weeks. You were a crew member. Your role was to document what happened during those 2 weeks in film. What were the larger goals of the project?
Right. So my goal, that's correct. I was embedded as a filmmaker, and then my role actually extended a bit as well. I ended up working on the telecommunication system between the rover and the control unit. So I did a little bit of Linux operating system troubleshooting. But that's part of the experience, is that everyone there has to be multifaceted and be able to do more than just their assigned task, because it's such a small group of people, and there are so many real world situations that everyone has to be able to deal with. The number of projects, each person brought one or more projects to the environment. Probably the most telling was extracting moisture from the soil. So Vibha, she was from India, and she came to find soil in that Utah analog that had a similar moisture content to what we expect to be the moisture content of the soil in certain regions of Mars. She then brought that soil back to the habitat, where she extracted water from it by cooking it in a pressure cooker. So she brought the same kind of pressure cooker you'd make your Thanksgiving turkey in, and she extracted the water from it and then used that water, broke it down into hydrogen, oxygen, and burnt the hydrogen, again, as an analog to creating rocket fuel from water on Mars.
She didn't blow up any tents or anything, right? Because she wasn't actually on Mars, right?
Correct. And after 10 days of work, the amount of fuel that she was able to extract was a very, very small... Sorry for the background noise.
Yeah.
She was a very small little pop, just a little blue flame that lasted about a third of a second, and that's it. So it took her 10 days to extract that amount of fuel. So no, nothing blew up other than the amount of hydrogen she collected in the test tube.
You have interviewed sci-fi authors and space researchers in your work. What have they taught you about the feasibility of human space colonization?
It's a good question. In fact, the timing is perfect. Just yesterday, I was interviewing Ben Bova in his summer home in Taos, New Mexico, and he's a well-known author, contemporary of Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury. And we talked extensively about that. And one of the questions I asked him was, how does science fiction and science fact, how are they interrelated? Does one lead the other? And his response was that they lead each other. It's a symbiotic relationship, that science fiction is a way of looking to the future and saying what's possible. And it inspires people to go to that future that has not yet happened. Science fact, the scientists, the research, the inventions and innovations, they're almost catching up to what science fiction has projected. But at the same time, it's the science reality. It's what we already have in terms of what we know, what we're learning, and what we're inventing that leads the science fiction authors to project the future and say what's possibly beyond what we have right now. And I think that's a wonderful way of describing it. Ben Bova's description was brilliant.
You know, Fraser Cain, sometimes I think when, you know, when I look at science fiction, it's more about philosophy, and in a world where, you know, in science fiction, you can create a world and you can decide how human or whatever are going to operate in that world. But there is a lot of technology involved in it. Are they, how much does the dream that you feel or you sense from some kind of science fiction play out in real life in your experience?
Well, there's two parts to it, right? There's the technologies that, you know, when you watch Star Trek and they're communicating on their communicators, or they've got these little devices that give them lots of information they hold in their hand, you know, back in the 1960s, 70s, that stuff just seemed like it would never happen, and yet suddenly here we are using them, and we're already bored of them and looking for larger screens.
Are you talking about our smartphones?
Yeah, our smartphones, okay. Right? So on one hand, we have these technologies that come in so quickly. It's just kind of mind-bending. But then on the other hand, there's all these other technologies that they use, all the other, you know, ways to shorten the plot, like methods of transportation. Artificial gravity is the big one, right? Like, when you look at them walking around their spaceships and their feet are touching the ground and they're feeling like normal Earth gravity as if they're on a ship, that's an incomprehensibly complicated technology to try and create, and is something that we will probably never be able to do. That it's always going to be about spinning spacecraft or things like that to try and simulate gravity. So it's always funny, and of course, when we think about this discovery of planets around Proxima Centauri, the next question everyone wants to know is, well, when can we go visit? When can we send humans there? But it will be so difficult for us to even send a 1 kilogram spacecraft all the way to make that distance, but to actually send spaceships with human beings who could colonize it. All of that technology is just so far beyond our reach. So it's funny to see how when science fiction makes these predictions, some of the things are actually very easy to accomplish, and we make them happen a lot sooner than we were ever expecting, while the others could be as close to magic.
Or something that we have yet to discover.
Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about, you know, what's possible in the realm of space travel, colonization of other planets, other celestial objects. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kai, what did you learn? You know, you said there was a crew. It was for 2 weeks. I was kind of wondering, coming up, we're going to be hearing from some people about the year-long simulation on a volcano on the side of a volcano in Hawaii. But what did 2 weeks tell you about what our chances are?
Well, I think the probably the answer to that, there's two sides to it. One you could look at as being the technological challenges, and the other one is the psychological or social psychological challenges. And they're both very real. The technical challenges, we don't yet have all the technology we need to live in an isolated colony for extended periods of time. We still are incapable of recycling our air beyond 65-75%, as demonstrated on the International Space Station. We do not have the capacity for recycling 100% of the water that we consume with our body in terms of, you know, how we exhale and such. Those are real challenges that are being addressed by government organizations and private sector as well. The social challenges, the psychosocial challenges, I think those are even greater than the technical challenges at some level. There's a gentleman named Norbert Croft, who was a former psychologist for NASA and helped develop some of their teams for these long-duration stays in space. And I had a long talk with him a couple of years ago when I was working with Mars One, and he said something brilliant. And I told him, I said, Norbert, I'll never, ever be able to go to Mars. I just can't tolerate other people well enough. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, somebody chewing with their mouth open would drive me insane. I can't imagine sitting in the same room with somebody who chews with their mouth open for 2 years. And he laughed. And he says, well, you can go to Mars. And I said, well, how? He said, we just have to make certain that everyone else in the crew doesn't chew with their mouth open. And I said, really? Is that actually a consideration? He said, absolutely. He wasn't joking. That at that level, for that intensity of stay, we have to choose people who are truly compatible for long durations. It doesn't mean there won't be fights. It doesn't mean there won't be disagreements. But that is one, the number one concern, and the technology is second.
Paul Sutter?
Yeah, I think Kai brings up a really good point that, and what's exciting for me is that these challenges of colonizing, say, Mars or the moon or asteroids, something within our solar system, it's an incredibly hard technological and sociological and psychological problem, but it's not impossible. There's no like law of physics that's preventing us from doing it. There's nothing that can stop us if we want to do it bad enough. And that's what makes it exciting to me.
I want to go back to the idea of growing food in space. NASA's studying ways to make it happen. I know you guys aren't botanists, but how would gravity and the soil factor into space farming? That was very interesting that, you know, in the Martian, which so many people have seen, so it's easy to make reference to it. He used human fecal matter to enrich the soil, which is actually very, very toxic. If there's one thing I've heard about that is that probably couldn't happen. It wouldn't be that easy. Paul Sutter?
Yeah, when it comes to growing something on, say, Mars, the Martian soil, that's not necessarily the problem. Soil is really just a place to hold the plant. Like when it comes to hydroponics, we don't even use soil. You just need something to hold the plant okay. In place. There are some technical issues with the Martian soil. It's full of perchlorates, which is actually a kind of rocket fuel, which you don't necessarily want in your food. But it's just a matter of rinsing off the soil. And then you have a nice medium for holding the plant. And obviously you need to fertilize it. You need to give it the nutrients. But if you put it in a greenhouse, if you're able to supply the nutrients, you can grow stuff on Mars. There's nothing in a controlled habitat. There's nothing stopping you from growing things on Mars. That's food. When it comes to growing people in a low gravity environment,
okay,
that might be a much bigger challenge. And that's something we don't fully understand. For example, the formation of our spine might depend on Earth's gravity to grow in a particular direction, to form a straight line. So if you're developing in space or if you're developing in a low gravity environment like the moon or Mars, that might severely impact our normal human growth and development.
Go ahead.
To build on that, there some of the experiments and some of the technological work being done is to say what kinds of body suits could we wear that would apply pressure on our body to simulate a higher atmospheric pressure, for instance, or to simulate gravity, to do exactly what Paul's discussing, that we don't fully understand how much gravity plays a part in the formation of our bodies. Are there ways that we could wear pressurized suits, very thin, you know, it would almost look like workout clothing that has ribs and pressurized tubes inside that might help our bodies adjust to that low G and maybe of different atmospheric pressure.
You're talking about body development, meaning raising young people up, you know, rearing someone in space. What about the degenerative impact? I mean, at this point, we're actually more concerned, aren't we, with just what it does to you after being up in a space station for a year. It was interesting to hear from the U.S. astronaut who was up there in the space station and for the longest time ever, I guess, along with a Russian colleague. He said that he had to relearn how to hold his head up. Something as basic as that. Fraser Cain, I mean, isn't it just about surviving at this point versus rearing someone?
Well, that's exactly right, that space is an incredibly hostile place. The microgravity causes all kinds of problems. It causes your bones to lose mass, causes your muscles to atrophy, causes problems with your vision, like your eyeballs change shape. Astronauts have reported, even like the Apollo astronauts years after, suffered higher levels of cardiovascular damage and heart attacks and stuff from when they came back from space. So we know, the one thing we know for sure is that living for long periods of time in microgravity is very hard on the human body. And so I think that, you know, the next step for us to really try to understand is how can we prevent or limit this amount of destruction to the body when you're in space? Can we create those, some kind of, as I was saying, those like pressure suits, things that can help kind of counteract and give like some pushback, give our muscles something to push back. The astronauts actually exercise a tremendous amount every day when they're in space. They're on treadmills and exercise bikes where they're trying to work their muscles and try to at least limit that amount of loss that's happening. But really, over the long term, there's going to need to be some kind of artificial gravity, some way that through spinning, rotating structures, you can give the astronauts a place where they can go that where the angular momentum, the spinning, gives them artificial gravity and gives them a place to let their bones strengthen, their muscles strengthen up as well. So that really is going to be the next big challenge to overcome. If we really want to live in space for long periods of time, we have to be able to simulate gravity.
Robert in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I had a question for the panel. Last week, a Chinese satellite was launched with some quantum communication stuff built in. And I know right now it takes something like a half an hour to even get a signal to Mars. And do you think in the future that quantum communication will allow instant communication anywhere? We're talking about going to, exoplanets. It would be good to have that kind of network. So is that feasible at this point or not?
Quantum communication. Paul Sutter?
Yeah, so let's talk about like quantum computers or quantum communication. If I take two fundamental particles and put them in a very special state where they're called entangled, and I flip one of them up, the other one will flip down automatically.
Okay.
And it appears instantaneous. And so I can actually separate these particles very, very far away from each other. And still, if I'm able to maintain them in this very special entangled state, if I flip one, I flip the other. The other flips automatically, No matter how far apart they are. So it appears like it's instantaneous communication. It looks like I can put this one pair of particles on Proxima Centauri, and even though a beam of light will take 4.25 years to reach Earth, if I flip that particle, its pair that's left on Earth will flip instantaneously. So that makes it look like faster than light communication is possible, but there's a little subtlety here. What's happening is if I'm just sitting on the Earth and I just have that particle, that pair, one of those pairs sitting there, my particle, I just see it flip up and down. Is it flipping up and down because of natural variation, or is it flipping up and down because its partner on another solar system is entangled within and it's flipping up and down? I can't actually receive any useful information until the person who flipped that its pair particle in the other solar system actually sends a normal everyday light speed limited signal over to Earth, say, oh yeah, this is the pattern of flips I did. So now you can kind of decode the message, you know, when I was flipping it and how I was flipping it. So even though this effect happens instantaneously, it doesn't actually transmit any useful information faster than light.
Harold and Bexley, you're on the air. Hi, Harold.
I had a question about magnetism in space, and does it work, and how does it work, if it works differently on Earth as in space, and is it currently used in any practical way in space? That last conversation made me wonder if you could create energy by flipping those particles, too. So,
Fraser?
Magnetism does work in space. Of course, the Earth magnetic field extends way out beyond the atmosphere of the Earth, and actually serves to protect the astronauts from fairly dangerous particles that are coming from the sun. And one of the ideas actually has been that you could create a spacecraft and have a magnetic bubble that surrounds it that would protect the astronauts on board the spacecraft from these dangerous particles that are going back and forth in space. So absolutely, magnetism works. I think, you know, could you generate energy from those particles? That might be moving into a perpetual motion machine, which I'm sure Paul would have issue with. But yeah, magnetism works in space.
I've got a problem with it.
Fraser Cain, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Also, Kai Stotz, thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Fraser Cain is publisher of UniverseToday.com and co-host of AstronomyCast.com. And Kai Stotz is a director and producer at Over the Sun. It's a film production company. And Paul Sutter, I have to say goodbye to you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Paul Sutter, astrophysicist at OSU and chief scientist at COSI. Coming up, we're going to hear more about that event in Hawaii. The participants spent a year on the side of a volcano. It was the closest they could come to mimicking life on Mars. We're going to hear more about that coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about living in space or on another planet. Conversation triggered in part by the recent news that six people have returned to Earth after living 1 year on Mars. Well, sort of. The crew of a NASA-funded Mars simulation spent 12 months under a dome on a volcano in Hawaii, the closest to a Mars habitat researchers could achieve on Earth. The mission was part of a program called High Seas. That's short for Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. Joining us by phone is the producer of the documentary film Red Haven, which is following the mission of the High Seas crew, Catherine Gorringe. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us, High Seas co-investigator and behavioral health and performance research coordinator, Dr. Pete Roma. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We were just talking about there's the technological challenges of space exploration. There's also the psychological, sociological challenges of space exploration. Dr. Roma, I mean, what did you learn from this year-long? Well, I'm sure you're going to be analyzing it for time, a long time to come. But what do we know now? I mean, there was a crew of, what, six or eight people, and they did okay.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We're a ton of data, and it'll take quite a bit of time to process all of it and get the final results out. But there were six people. We had a mixed gender crew, half men, half women. So many different types of studies, types of data being collected. It was a very rich project. And as you mentioned, our focus is largely on the behavioral health and performance issues, some of the team performance issues, group cohesion, and things like that. One of the big overarching themes that we've seen throughout all the High Seas missions, and including, if not especially, the year-long one, is the very large overlap between kind of work, how teams work well together, and how they live well together. Mm-hmm. Because you really don't have much of a choice in isolation. In a typical workplace, you have outlets where if you don't get along with a coworker, you can physically remove yourself from situations. You have privacy. You can go home at the end of the day. In isolation, extreme environments, that really is not a choice. But the overlap between work and personal is huge. And so the value of understanding that phenomena in extreme environments and developing countermeasures and methods to manage that and keep teams working well together is very important.
Is this something that NASA has been working at for a long time, even though maybe you're only going to be in confined circumstances for a few days with another astronaut, that it is what it is and it's been a concern, something they're always looking for that right match?
It's always, yes. It, always been a concern. One of the emerging areas of interest for research with NASA, and this is manifest largely in high seas, is in the team issues. So much of what we traditionally think about of astronaut space exploration is individual selection. Who are the best individuals based on skills? One of the things we're learning more and more about with every project is the importance of composition. So not just how qualified any one person is, but what's the right mix of individuals. So someone who might have, quote, the right stuff in one circumstance or one mission type may not be the best person for a very long duration mission or colonization effort. Also in relation to the other people that they're working with.
Catherine Gorringe, tell us about the crew. What were they? What did they tell you about what they hope to achieve inside the dome?
Yeah, well, I think their motivations differ for every crew member. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them want to be astronauts and have wanted to be astronauts since they were children and have dreamt of that. And, you know, this is them taking one step closer. And actually, three of the crew members applied to be an astronaut through NASA's last round of applications. Some of them are just hardcore scientists, and they want to be able to do their research and be able to help the future missions that NASA might do. And so this is also their way of contributing to the future of humanity and possibly actually putting humans on Mars, as well as just having a space to be doing their research. Cyprian is one of the crew members, and he's an astrobiologist. And so he was definitely locked himself in the lab for a great part of the mission, doing research about how to grow plants and be sustainable on Mars.
Were any of them nervous about being the weak link in something like this?
I don't think so, just because I think that none of them really have kind of that personality. They're all pretty confident and competent and know that they can really contribute to a group. So I think the question was more what the crew dynamic was going to be and kind of how everyone was going to fit in and be cohesive with each other at the beginning. And then, you know, they figured that out as they went along.
I heard an NPR interview with one of the crew members, and they kind of talked about, you know, what food they missed and that kind of a thing. And I was wondering how they engaged with each other as they emerged from the dome after that year of isolation. What did you see, Catherine?
Yeah, how they engage with each other since they've come out.
Yeah.
Well, I think they've actually had a pretty crazy week. Yeah. They've had a ton of media attention. There's just been so much interest in this mission and what's been going on and the kind of like fascinating work that they're doing. And they've also been doing a lot of debriefing, which Pete can speak to, where, you know, they actually have to talk about what happened and their experiences so they can collect all this data. So I'm not even sure that they've seen each other that much.
And I wonder how weird that
their families are.
Yeah, I just wonder kind of how weird that is. Pete Roma, you know, I mean, even though they might not have always gotten along and there might have been friction here and there and, you know, someone got tired of listening to someone else chew with their mouth full or something like that, I would imagine the only people who really understand what they went through was each other.
They are part of almost like a family or a fraternity or a club. Very few people have done what they've done, even here on Earth. As few people have been to space, very few people have done studies like they've done for this fall. So that is very true. They're all very capable, very competent, dedicated, and hardworking. And even in this crazy debrief week and post-mission data collection that we've been running them through, they've still been getting the job done. So they're quite remarkable.
In all of the research you did, how do you correct for the notion that A, they knew they'd get out if they had to, and B, they knew they would be out in a year at the most?
Right. That's sort of an inherent challenge to any kind of research model. We use an analogy that missions like this, studies like this, are sort of a ship in a bottle, where you pick the fundamental.
Are you there?
Trying to study, and in this case, the isolation, the confinement is very real. So there's always that possibility. They all know their rights as research participants, that they could leave if they needed to. If they refused to do something, they could.
We keep getting out. Catherine Gorringe, what has it been like to try to document this process from where you sit?
Well, it's definitely been a challenging way to make a documentary. We were here last year for their last few days on Earth, or so to speak, filming with our crew. And then when they went in the dome, of course, we're not allowed to be there mm-hmm. while they're living in the dome because it would break the simulation. So we really leave it to the crew for them to kind of film their daily experiences. And you know, the crew all participated in that and taking video and kind of showing what it was like to be there. They were growing plants, they're cooking together, they're exercising constantly, and just everything that they did. So we were able to see some of that footage and were able to send emails back and forth with them on a delay. But it's definitely different, very different from making a documentary normally, where you're face to face with your subjects and constantly building a relationship, and we're actually doing the filming the whole time. So it's actually kind of an exciting thing because the documentary is so much in their hands, the way it was filmed and the way that they're depicted.
Were they sending you their product over time, or did you have to wait a year to see it?
Yeah, they were able to Dropbox us some clips, but of course, uploading from Mars is kind of a tedious process. So we were able to get some footage, but then as soon as they came out, they gave us a drive with additional footage. So we have a lot to look through in the next month or so.
Dr. Pete Roma, were there some unanticipated challenges that the crew encountered during that year-long mission? Things you weren't expecting?
Things that they weren't expecting. There are always challenges because you never know what it will be like to go through something that so few people have done. Mm-hmm. You don't have a whole lot to go from, you know, sort of a knowledge base to work off of outside of the literature on long voyages and military deployments and things like that. So there are always unexpected things. The mix of people, what that will produce over time.
Right. So any happy surprises?
Happy surprises. Well, I think there are always happy surprises. Many of the crew were kind of surprised about how well they adapted to it. That sort of speaks to their dedication and their character and their qualifications and their interest in serving humanity, essentially. So there was some surprise that living in that environment was in some ways not as difficult as they thought.
And Catherine, your film is entitled Red Heaven. You have a Kickstarter going to help fund the documentary right now. You're a little over 10,000 shy of your goal. What happens next?
We'll finish the Kickstarter and hopefully reach our goal by September 18th. And then we're really starting to move into post-production. So we'd like to do a lot of archival footage because this film really, it depicts what it's like to actually live on Mars or what it might actually be like. But we're also interested in kind of Mars and the cultural imagination and why we dream of living on Mars and kind of the history of that. So we'll be doing that work and then just starting to edit and put a film together.
Well, best wishes. I look forward to seeing it.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Gorringe, she is the documentary filmmaker of Red Heaven that will chronicle the experiences of the six-person crew on the in Hawaii that was in a simulated Mars environment. Also, Dr. Pete Roma is the High Seas co-investigator and behavioral health and performance research coordinator. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
And now A Little Starman by David Bowie.